What a pleasure to be with you. And isn't it nice to think that maybe winter's almost over in these beautiful mornings? And so I'd love to see how many of you were raised as Unitarian Universalists? Okay, so about four or five of you. And so for the rest of you, I'd like you to think for a moment about the first day you came into one of our Unitarian Universalist congregations. I'm guessing you remember. For me, it was 1986. We were living in Rockville, Maryland when our daughter was born. My husband, Ralph, comes from a Catholic background but had abandoned the church in his teenage years. I had grown up in a secular Jewish household, had become quite involved with synagogue as a teenager, but when I discovered feminism in college, I could no longer tolerate a religion that at that time at least only talked about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and that didn't recognize women as lay leaders or clergy or even counting in the 10 people needing for prayer. When Ralph and I were dating and then later married, we liked to say we ate our religion. We had chicken soup and challah at Rosh Hashanah. We had a wonderful 7-fish Italian dinner on Christmas Eve. We had chicken soup and matzah and haroses at Passover, ham on Easter, and so on. But when we had a child, we decided we thought she should know more than food. And so we went church shopping, and I'm guessing this is not dissimilar for many of you. We were invited by our dear friend and my dear colleague, the late Dr. Douglas Kirby, to go with him to the Unitarian Church on River Road in Bethesda. He said to me, "You have to promise to come twice. Some weeks are not as good." Now, that first service was Mother's Day. The minister preached about Gaia, the Earth Mother. The choir sang feminist anthems, and I was hooked immediately. It took Ralph a few more weeks. But what I felt that day, like so many people have shared with me, they felt the first time they came to a Unitarian Universalist service, was a sense that I had found my people, my home, that this was the religious community that I had longed for. I loved that the church was feminist and social justice seeking, that the minister used many sacred texts and didn't present any one truth, and that I wasn't going to be asked to give up my previous identity. But most of all, I loved that rather than providing us with preformed answers, the minister asked us to ponder questions in our own hearts. A year later, we moved to Connecticut to take new jobs, and we began attending the congregation that ultimately ordained and endorsed me. Coming home from church one day that first year, I asked our 3-year-old daughter, "What happened at Sunday school today, honey? What'd you learn?" And she said, "I learned about God." And I took a deep breath, and in my best non-judgmental parenting, non-anxious voice said, "What did you learn about God, honey?" And she said, "I learned that God is the happiness inside my heart." That was a God I could believe in. I think I joined the next week. The Reverend Dr. Forrest Church, who I hope you have heard of or know, a great Unitarian Universalist minister taken from us too soon, wrote in what he called his last sermon, "Religion is our human response to the dual reality of being alive and having to die. We are not the animal with advanced language or tools as much as we are," "as much as we are the religious animal. Knowing that we must die, we question what life means. The answers we arrive at may not be religious answers, but the question death forces us to ask are at heart religious questions. Where did I come from? Who am I? Where am I going? What is life's purpose? He wrote, "The goal is to live in such a way that our lives will prove worth dying for. The goal is to live in such a way that our lives will prove worth dying for." Poet Mary Oliver, who I think we adopt as a Unitarian Universalist saint, although I've been told she's a practicing Presbyterian, asked in her poem similarly, "Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" Seeking our own answers to life's central questions, I believe, is the heart of Unitarian Universalism. It is not, as some critics believe, that we can believe anything we want to, but rather that we understand, based in our belief in the dignity and worth of all people and the interdependent web of existence, that it is ultimately up to each one of us to come up with our own answers to how we live, how we will find meaning, how we will live in a way that proves worth dying for. My goal as a minister is to help those I serve find their own answers to these questions in a spiritually nourishing community. It is never to suggest that because of my position that I have some magical power or wisdom to tell you what your answer should be. My friends who are clergy in other traditions are asked to teach their congregants creedal statements like the Nicene Creed, or to believe that they have what an Episcopal priest friend of mine calls magic hands that can turn water and wafers into the sacraments. Yet almost all of my Christian clergy friends have expressed to me that they have doubts about what they're teaching. UU ministers are never put in that position. Our own Ralph Waldo Emerson taught that the membership of the church is always one. What he meant by that was that regardless of tradition or teaching, or church or congregation, every individual always reaches their own answers for themselves. So as a religious community, we gather together to raise the central questions of life and to seek to understand for ourselves our own understandings of the sacred and how to live well in the time we have. Theological questions, by definition, are about how we understand the divine. In some of my best moments, I experience a deep sense of belief and grace that we live in a beneficent knowing that it is ineffable and so much greater than we can know. In my most troubling personal moments, I tend to reach out to an interventionist God, who I actually don't really believe in. I can illustrate this with a story. On a plane trip to lobby in Congress a few years ago, I was wearing my clerical collar. I only wear clerical collars when I go to lobby or and try to make a public statement. But I'm wearing my clerical collar, and we hit that very bad late afternoon thunderstorm you sometimes get leaving DC. Some of you have been on that plane, right? And so I am sitting there, and I am holding on to this chair, and I am praying my little heart out to that God to please, please, please let this plane get there safely. And the man next to me leaned over and pulled on my shirt and said, "Pastor, you're freaking the rest of us out." Let me just say, I no longer wear clerical collars on airplanes. But between that beneficent knowing and that interventionist person, there are those other moments when I feel deep in my bones that our being right here today on this earth together and what happens to us is nothing but random. I feel that way when I hear the news of natural disasters where thousands of lives are ended in earthquakes or floods or tsunamis. I feel that way when I am called to witness the deep personal suffering of others because of untreatable cancer or fatal accidents or unrelenting poverty. My belief that there is a beneficence in the universe has been severely shaken in work I've done in the slums of India and Brazil. In the emergency room, watching a mother lose her only son in a motorcycle accident, waiting ourselves for results in a pediatric neurology clinic. How could there be a God that cares in the face of such loss and suffering? At times of crisis, the previously esoteric theological questions become intensely personal. It's not at all unusual to hear people saying, "Why God?" or "Where was God?" Others seek to give God a role in what happened. I remember a conversation coming back on a train right after 9/11 in New York City. Our area was badly damaged and brutally shaken in 9/11. Our congregation lost two brothers. And this man on the train said to me, "God must have meant for this to happen. Otherwise, he would have turned the plane around." I cannot, I am sure you cannot, to paraphrase the Sufi mystic Heifetz, imagine a God that would make us so sad. Many responses to personal tragedies, I think, ring hollow. Has anyone ever said to you, "Everything happens for a reason," or "It was meant to be"? My personal least favorite, "God doesn't give you more than you can handle." I was told all of them when I miscarried a very wanted pregnancy. None of them helped. Sometimes I think "life sucks" is a much more honest theological answer. And certainly a response to people, a simple "I'm sorry," is much better and a much more supportive answer. Blaming God for tragedies or thanking God for being spared them is just too limited an understanding of the divine for me. My guess is that almost all of us in this room reject the Jim Carrey or George Byrne movie views of God as a puppeteer somewhere controlling all of us, or sitting at some master computer answering email requests. A recent New Yorker cartoon had God in heaven saying, "I can't talk to you right now. I'm deciding on a Hail Mary football pass." I was trained by Forest Church to say that when people tell you they don't believe in God, say to them, "Tell me about the God you don't believe in." When they describe the old man in heaven who controls our destiny, I tell them, "I don't believe in that God either." Questions about how to reconcile an omnipotent, beneficent God with evil and struggle in the world is known by the theological term theodicy. Theodicy literally means justifying God. We are hardwired to want to believe that tragic things happen for a reason. We want to believe there's a greater plan, a purpose to our suffering, a lesson that we must learn, and so on. The fact is that human beings have always tried to make sense of how to live in an insecure world, whether the threat was from wild beasts or the threat is from ISIS. To be human is to be vulnerable. More than 50 years ago, Reverend William Sloan Coffing wrote, "The world is too dangerous for anything but truth and too small for anything but love." I think those words apply now. The Buddha taught that life is suffering and that no one is immune. There is no one in this room older than, say, the age of 15, and maybe that's too old, who has not experienced deep sadness or grief or hurt. I'm sorry, I am just not used to this. I know that many of you in this community are suffering right now. There is what Wayne Muller in his book Sabbath called a level of inevitable in knowing, a level of inevitable unknowing in life. We can plan, but we don't actually know what's going to happen. I have learned in the last 20 years in ministry and in my own life that the worst things in life can rarely be predicted. The diagnosis, the fatal car crash, the sudden illness, the person ending the relationship, the bad news phone call. See, what we as Unitarian know is that we can't promise people that the answering to suffering is a better life someday somewhere else. Our faith teaches us that salvation is universal. None of us are condemned to live lives of hell, either here on this earth or in another plane. We need to live into what the Reverend John Buren's labeled a realized eschatology. What those words means is that we know we are already standing on holy ground. That it is this earth, this time, that is the only one for sure that we know we have been given. The only one we may ever have. And it is up to us individually and in community to create this time on earth well. Yet sometimes holy ground is shaky ground. And I think that's where you all are right now. And then the theological questions become practical ones. This may not be ever so true as in the time of transition, the time between the announcement of the ending and the time where there is knowledge of new beginning. You are in a community just at that beginning of that in-between time. But many of us are living in our own personal time of transitions, of change and uncertainty. And it is in those times of transition that we may most struggle to find answers to our questions. Change is a constant in our lives. Job changes, relationship changes, changes in where we live, the deaths and the births. How many of you have gone through a major transition in the last year? So, a lot of you. Sometimes we need to have the courage to begin our own endings. Steve Jobs, in his commencement address at Stanford in 2005, several years before his death, wrote, "When I was 17, I read a quote that went like this: If you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right." Jobs continued, though, "Since then, I have looked into the mirror each morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I am about to do today?" And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. So, you see, sometimes we have to listen to that no for too many days and make that difficult decision to let go of all we know and take that leap into the unknown. So what helps us is that there are key questions we can ask and seek to answer during those transitions and those scary in-between times. More than 15 years ago, when I was moving and trying to decide from how I was going to leave a good job and go and become a full-time student and go to seminary, I found a wonderful little book that perhaps some of you know called Transitions. Any of you know it? A few people. By a man named, appropriately enough, William Bridges. Bridges' central question that he asked is, what would be left undone if your life ended today? Poet Donna Markova, in another book I like, wrote, what is it too soon for? What is it too late for? What is it just the right time for? I've heard the principles of Buddhism described with four simple statements. Show up. Speak the truth. Do what you do with enthusiasm. Don't get attached to the outcome. I'm guessing many of you are like me, and we do pretty well with the first three. But for many people, don't get attached to the outcome is the most difficult. It's another way of saying, live the questions. And yet, despite how difficult that is, I think in many ways it's our greatest spiritual challenge. We must learn to live with our hearts and our hands open to an unknown future. To learn to live and wake up each day with curiosity. And to have faith, if not necessarily in something external, in ourselves and in each other. Several years ago, as I began to discern my vocational call was again beginning to shift, I felt that I was inside a chrysalis. I didn't know what was coming next. My call to parish ministry was just beginning to emerge. But I also felt I needed to be in that quiet, dark place. One of my closest friends, who is also a minister, said to me, echoing the story I told the children today, "You do know, Deborah, what happens if you break the chrysalis before it's time." I believe that it is in covenantal religious community that we can find the support we need as we seek our own answers during these times of transition. Right after the Sandy Hook Elementary School shootings, which took place about 15 minutes from my church, all of the ministers in town reported that we had standing room only Sunday services. People turn to their church or synagogue communities when they seek answers about the tragedies around us. But at these times, the questions are not about a desire for theology or liturgy. We come together at those times for the same reasons we come together for weddings and memorial services. We seek each other's comfort. We seek each other's kindness. We seek the community we offer each other. We need one another. We want to share the joys of our lives together. We know that we cannot face tragedy alone. We know that it is in community that we can tolerate the suffering and the dying, the changes and the in-between times. There is a sign over my desk that reads, "Peace." It doesn't mean to be in a place where there is no noise, no trouble, no hard work. It means to be in the midst of those things and still be calm in your heart. When we feel that peace about ourselves, about our relationship, about our career, about the doing art, about walking in nature, about listening to music, or in this very congregation, we feel truly engaged in our lives and more alive. We know at those moments, deep in ourselves, that life is more about love and connection than it is about suffering. When we are truly connecting with our partner, hugging our children or our grandchildren, watching the sunset, hiking in nature, or doing good work together, we are reminded for a moment that life is impossibly precious, that life is impossibly beautiful. There are times in my home congregation that I feel my heart crack open with love for the community that loved me into ministry. When we experience those moments of grace, we rest into the questions themselves. I want to end with a story of a small village a long, long time ago. In that village, like in every village a long, long time ago, there was a wise old woman. And the people in the town revered her and would go to her with all of their problems and questions. Some of the teenagers in that town, like some teenagers ever since, doubted their elders and sought to discredit the wise old woman. And they kept trying to come up with ideas, and one day the leader of this pack said, "I've got it. We will go to the wise woman, and I will have a bird in my hand. And I will say to the wise woman, is the bird in my hand alive or dead?' And if the wise woman says, alive, I will crush the bird, and I'll show her a dead bird. But if the woman says, the bird is dead, I will open my hands, and the bird will fly away. So they thought that was a pretty good idea, and they climbed the hill. They went to the wise woman's home. They knocked on the door. She came out and saw the teenagers, and the leader said, wise woman, if you are so wise, is this bird in my hand dead or alive? She looked at them. She looked at them for a really long time. She was very quiet. So quiet that they could barely stand it. And then she spoke to them. She looked at each of them and said, the answer is in your hands. The answers are in your hands. Your hands for your own life and your hand as a religious community. So here's what I want to leave you with. Show up. Speak your truth. Be together with love and enthusiasm. Try not to get attached to the outcome. Remember Rilke, live everything. Live the questions now. Have trust. Have faith that when you are ready, the answers will emerge. And so may it be.